and deliver and install.
And you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. Hi, I'm Mary Glennie, and my colleague Arlene Engelhardt is not going to be with us today. In fact, she probably won't be with us for another few weeks. Last week, she had a knee replacement, and as I'm sure many of you are aware, that is not a walk in the park, but she is doing well and adjusting to the situation. And to tell you the truth, I think her pain was compounded by the lightning's adventures. So anyway, I'm on my own today, but we've got a really good show planned for you. And I'm really excited about all of this. First, we're going to be actually kind of investigating Earth Day and really looking at the theme this year, which is protect our species. And then if we have a little more time, we'll be talking with actually Macy Placide from Earth Day Network about that. And then we should have a little time to bring in B. Ruiz with the Extinction Rebellion. I hope you've been following all that in Britain. And then in the second hour, I'm going to be talking to Nadine Epstein. And she is actually the editor of a really pretty extraordinary magazine, Moment. And she's going to be talking about the vilification of George Soros. And I think it, kind of in a way, I think it relates to the desecration of nature and kind of what's happening in our world today. And so I think it should be really, really quite interesting. So I think it's going to be a really full, interesting show. And at the end of the show, a really terrific group. I know so many of you absolutely love them. I know I do. The Indigo Girls are coming, and they're going to be at Ruth Eckert Hall in Clearwater, and it's going to be May 3rd, Friday. And we will have a pair of tickets to give away, but that will be with a $100 pledge. So count your pennies and see if you can afford that. The Indigo Girls are always worth it, and you know that it all goes to WMNF. So with that in mind, I am going to put on the Indigo Girls, because I thought on these times, it's an oldie, but I still love it very much. And then we shall be coming back with Macy Placide. This down because I'm really excited to say we have our guest with us on the phone, Macy Placide. And Macy Placide actually is with the Earth Day Network, and she is in charge actually of Protect Our Species campaign. She leads policy development, research, and recognizing, you know, the understanding the situation. And she's been involved actually with trying to protect the voiceless ones. I really like that. And prior to going to Earth Day Network, she had positions in the U.S. Senate and several conservation organizations. And now that she's not only been concerned about dogs, cats, and all animals that are voiceless, so to speak, in sense of words, but she's also right now also following the problem with shark fins, and that's soon going to be published, I think. So, Macy Placide, welcome so much to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, I mean, the theme this year, Protect Our Species, is a sober one, I really find. And, you know, that we're, you know, we've all been following climate change and so many other aspects of that. But when you actually see it in terms of the numbers, it's kind of sobering, I think.
Right, yes. You know, one of the reasons that we launched this campaign, the Protect Our Species campaign at Earth Day Network, is because we are seeing an existential crisis. And that means we are currently within the sixth mass extinction. And there has been no extinction like it in the previous five extinctions that have taken place on Earth. And in fact, what we're seeing are declines of species worldwide. We are seeing land animal populations that have declined by 40%. We're seeing insect populations, which are declining by 40%, and in fact, declining even more in other regions of the world by at most of 75%. Marine animal populations are also in decline. And, you know, there are a number of causes that can be contributed to this, but one of the reasons that we have launched this campaign is because we want to do several things. We want to achieve major policy victories that protect our species and their habitats. And we want to build and we want to activate a global movement that embraces nature and its values, you know. And we also want to educate and raise awareness about the accelerating rate of extinction, including the causes of extinction and the consequences, which are tremendous. And lastly, one of the major things is we really want to encourage individual action, because as we have seen and we've seen time and time before, especially with the first Earth Day, is that individual actions can lead to massive changes.
Yeah, it's all connected, and I think that's perhaps what we most need to be aware of, that, and we are also part of those connections. And so you mentioned the factors that are involved in this, and so real quickly, let's go over some of those factors for the mass, frankly, the mass extinction what we're seeing.
Yes, so there are a number of things that are, you know, contributed to this mass extinction, and the difference here is that they're all related to humans, to us. We're, you know, we are creating an environment now where species are no longer able to perform how they naturally perform in their natural environments. And as a result, our ecosystems are in decline. For instance, pollinators. Pollinators contribute billions of dollars to the worldwide economy. And without them, ecosystems are collapsing. And as a result, humans will suffer. You know, and to take it down to Florida, for instance, you know, there are a number of wonderful species that are currently being threatened by the effects of climate change. You know, we're seeing sea turtles, which I understand currently is nesting season in the coastal waters off of Florida. And they come to shore, they lay their eggs, and, you know, when they go back into the ocean, we're finding a larger majority of female turtles because of climate change. You know, the determination of the gender of sea turtles is not genetics, it's the temperature in the sand. And so as a result of rising temperatures, we're seeing a greater increase of female turtles species. And as a result, this has the impact of affecting our populations of sea turtles overall. In addition, Florida has the largest coral reef system in North America. And, you know, there is currently a coral disease outbreak occurring along the coast. And there are a number of factors that can contribute to, you know, the bleaching of coral reefs, you know, which also can be found in certain chemicals of sunscreens. And so what we want to really engage for individual action.
Just a minute there, because there are all kinds of things, you know, and we're really worried about everything, but the coral reefs have particular attention here in Florida. And you mentioned, because you go to any beach and you will see the sunscreen being slathered just to try and stop skin cancer, melanoma, et cetera. And so what sunscreen agents are a negative to the reef?
Sure. Well, there are particularly two chemicals which research have said are harmful for coral reefs and marine species, and those include oxybenzone and octinoxate. And what's wrong with these particular chemical compounds is that they leach into the water systems in the oceans, and they can be absorbed by corals, and they can disrupt reproduction and growth. And as a result, corals can turn white and die. And this is the process that I mentioned known as bleaching. And so some of the low-hanging fruit that people can take for actions are to buy and only use these chemical-free sunscreens in order to help protect marine species and our coral reefs.
And also with the coral reefs, we're very concerned. You mentioned the temperature of the sand, but also the temperature of the ocean. And if we keep increasing, at least what I was reading, the temperature of the ocean, that actually corals do not tolerate this increased heat. And if it continues, that we will lose all of our coral reefs by 2040 to 2050.
Yes, and the numbers are really quite frightening when you look at it from a global perspective. You know, we're seeing the Great Barrier Reef, which is in significant decline as well, and in fact, new baby coral reef are just as threatened as existing coral reef. In fact, a new study came out saying that 89% of those baby coral reef are unable to fully grow to capacity because of warming temperatures. And this is really a threat to the natural ecosystems, and it's a concern for all. And there are a number of steps that we encourage people can take. And if you want to learn more about what you can do to help protect our species and to take greater action, you can also visit our website, earthday.org. We have a number of wonderful campaigns and ways in which individuals can take action.
And again, we're talking to Macy Placide, and she's with Earth Day Network, and Earth Day does come up Monday, April 22nd, and and you also are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater, and you know, Macy, that again, I'm reiterating, because I think the biggest problem is that we don't tend to look at that beautiful, absolutely internetting lace of life, so to speak, and you mentioned the insect population, and people say, oh, well, you know, particularly down here, we just as soon not have all those mosquitoes. But we're also not only talking about the pollinators, but we're talking about a very important food source, like for birds. And the, among other reasons, the bird population is declining very precipitously. And so once again, you know, that you have to understand really what happens to one will happen to all.
Absolutely. I agree 100%. Everything on this earth is interlinked in some way. And whether we see these species or not, or, you know, down to the dancing grasshopper to the largest charismatic megafauna of elephant, they're all interconnected and they all have a reason for being here on this earth. And so one of the values that Earth Day Network wants to, you know, highlight is that there is an intrinsic value to all of these species, and it is our role and our responsibility to help protect them.
And, you know, Macy, I think a real problem, because it's not like this has just all of a sudden exploded into our consciousness. We've been really, people have tried, scientists have tried to alert us at least for the last 30 years. And I think actually that in 1992, that the Union of Concerned Scientists, you know, got a bunch of Nobel Prize winners, and practically all the living Nobel Prize winners that have won any science award, you know, published a letter in which they were warning about what was happening to the earth. And then once again in 2017, over 15,000 of them tried again to warn us that we're really literally running out of time, and we're getting very close. In fact, in some areas we also have tipping points. And you know, Macy, what I find the problem is that, you know, we have a very wonderful radio station, a lot of activists, and they, many of them have been involved in environmental causes, you know, for the you know, the beaches, cleaning up the sands, et cetera, really being worried and concerned and fighting with the horizon blowout. But it has reached a point that I was talking to one very fine activist. She's been in the fight forever. And she said it's reached the point that she can't listen to anything about climate change because she feels such despair. And frankly, she feels it's reached such a critical stage, and the politics and the real push just doesn't seem to be there. What do you think?
Well, I have to agree. There's a lot happening where the current, you know, political environment we're in can seem very depressing and seem very negative. However, you know, one of the things that Earth Day Network drives home is if it can be done at a federal level, then we take it locally, and we do things at the local level, and we work to be the voice to make change. You know, we've seen progress has slowed. We see climate change impacts grow, and we see our adversaries have become better financed. But that being said, there's so many things that we can do. You know, we can vote for candidates at the national and the local level who understand the threats of climate change for our planet species and who make species protection a priority. So there are a number of ways in which we can still be a voice. And in fact, we have plans put into action for Earth Day 2020, which will be the 50th anniversary of Earth Day. And so what we're planning to do is launch the most diverse and passionate global environmental movement in history. And so for anybody who doesn't feel that they have a voice or that they can't be a part of history and help protect nature and the environment, we encourage you to join our movement and be a part of our 50th anniversary.
And I don't know if with your organization you're allowed to comment, but what do you think about some of the proposals with the Green New Deal?
Well, I think there's a lot of proposals being initiated that are really important that relate to the environment. You know, I can't speak to that individually at this time, but I, you know, our organization also tries to advance, you know, policies that encourage protection for species and really focus on protecting and working on the threats of climate change. So any proposal that is in stewardship of the environment, of course, we 100% are going to support.
Okay, well, we've gone through this pretty quickly, Macy Placide. Are any things that we didn't cover that you particularly wanted to mention?
Well, I would just say thank you once again for having me. And for anybody who wants to learn more about the Protect Our Species campaign this year, the other campaigns that we have, and what we're planning on doing for the 50th anniversary next year for Earth Day, we encourage you to take a look on our website at earthday.org. And in fact, this year on Earth Day on Monday, which is the day we'll be working across the nation, we have team members who will be across various states celebrating Earth Day. And in fact, we will have a staff member who will be at the 14th annual Central Florida Earth Day. So anybody who's in the Orlando area who would like to speak with somebody from Earth Day Network, we will have somebody there.
Well, thank you so much, Macy. Wonderful work, and Earth Day Network has done wonderful work. I remember actually when you had Helen Caldicott, we had Helen Caldicott on one of the first days of Earth Days I can remember that we had in our area. So good tradition. And tell me, don't you think we need Earth Day every day?
Absolutely. And that's one of the things we say here is Earth Day. Make Earth Day every day.
Okay, well, thank you so much, and you do take care.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye. And again, you're listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater Community Conscious Radio. And I want to quickly get this announcement in that there's a wonderful group, actually, Two Men in a Truck, Movers for Moms. They have this policy, and they support local organizations. And I believe here they are supporting the Spring and Sunrise at St. Pete, and or excuse me, the Spring. And so they're collecting things that are really important. And this year's drive, they have a list. It's a very, very long list. I can't really read all of it. But they collect the kind of things that a person needs, you know, who has to leave their home, et cetera. And they have it both what they need at their home, but also in the shelter, and everything from children's needs, you know, like diapers, toothpaste, baby lotion, et cetera, to cleaning supplies. And it's just an enormous list. And I would say that if you want to serve it, you go to their website, which is Two Men in the Truck. And .com/movers4moms. And WMNF is a pickup area. And so you need to get it in. They're going to pick it up actually May 6th. And so it's a wonderful thing. There are so many things you need. And so it's a way we can help each other. Okay, well, I'm looking at the time, and I won't have time for all of this. But I was able to catch up with one of the organizers of the Extinction Rebellion. And they feel a little more urgency, or they express it differently, I guess I should say. And so let's hear a little bit of this with B. Ruiz. I'm going to get in the middle of it because we won't have time for all of it, but some of it. And Extinction Rebellion a couple of weeks ago. And she was telling me, and this is a very definite activist, you know, she's been fighting, you know, tans across the sea and, you know, for beach cleanup and all that. And she fought against the Gulf Horizon, what was happening, fighting against fracking. She's been in the front line, so to speak. And she told me that she has reached the point of such discouragement and despair because she watches so little being done and no real political response. And she's kind of reached a point of despair. And so I see a lot of people with that. I mean, I it's understandable, but to tell you the truth, that is the last thing we can have right now. And so, and I don't know about you, but to me, I think it almost requires the kind of effort that we did with World War II. I mean, and all the world, so to speak, responding. And to me, the crisis is that urgent. And so how, because frankly, we really are running out of time. I mean, how do you, what are your hopes that this will catch on and people, hopefully by the millions, will turn out? I mean, what are you hoping for?
Well, we're not just hoping. We're actively organizing and trying to make strategic plans, which is what I think is one of the things that we as movements have to do more of, is to really be relentless and determined to make plans and evaluate those plans and then adopt new plans rather than just continuing to do things by rote that we assume may work even though they haven't worked for decades.
And tell
go ahead.
Do you have any organizing efforts here in the Southeast and particularly in Florida?
Yes, we have several groups in Florida. If people go to extinctionrebellion.us and you click take action, you can find a sign-up page where it will show all the different locations that we have. And there's definitely a few in Florida. So in our mind, what we are organizing for is trying to build the capacity to be able to do mass civil disobedience, not just at the level that's happening in the UK, though that is amazing. It's absolutely been astonishing what they're doing and what they're going to continue to do. So, for example, what Extinction Rebellion UK is doing right now, this week, for the last few days, is continue to escalate, continue to do major disruption with thousands and thousands of people, and more importantly, they have vowed to continue, and they are coming back to some locations they've gone to before. So the pattern in the U.S. has been, and I think it's probably the pattern as well in the U.K., is that when people do civil disobedience, it usually lasts for one day at most. People don't keep returning to the same location. So it's quite symbolic what's most of what's happened here in the U.S., except for Standing Rock. Standing Rock, I think, is an example of the kind of serious, brave determination using civil disobedience the way it should be done. What I'm discussing is more like the mainstream environmental movement. We'll organize a civil disobedience that will last for a few hours. It'll be a coordinated arrest. People probably will not be held. So what people are doing in Extinction Rebellion UK in the U.S., they're doing mass disruption, and they're holding that disruption indefinitely. They're not trying to just stay there for a few hours and then everyone goes home. And then they're continuing for days, day after day after day. They're escalating and they're finding new areas to disrupt. They've shut down bridges. They've shut down roadways. Today they're shutting down the subways. This is a much different level of coordination and disruption. So we want to build up scale and people power in the U.S. to be able to do those kinds of actions here as well. And more than that, we want to eventually launch a coordinated national rebellion that shuts down the government and business as usual indefinitely until the government agrees to come to the negotiating table.
And so this isn't a protest. This is a rebellion, peaceful, nonviolent,
yeah,
but a rebellion.
Yes, it's a rebellion because we need to do something qualitatively different than has ever happened before. We have a problem that is unprecedented. We are completely failing to solve the problem, and therefore we need to do something that's never been done before regarding climate change. And that is a rebellion.
Well, I repeat, to me, it's like a World War II effort. I mean,
exactly.
Maybe it hasn't
been
quite as abrupt as a Pearl Harbor attack, but the attack, and it's, we're attacking ourselves. I mean, we are the ones that we have to deal with. And that's pretty, that says it, Extinction Rebellion. So, okay, Bay, I really get what you people are about, and I will certainly be following it, and I'm going to try and get some contacts with what's happening here in Florida. So I'm looking at the clock. Is there are there any, I'm sure there are many, but any areas you wanted to emphasize before I let you go?
Areas of the country?
No, I meant any topics related to this that we didn't mention that you particularly wanted to talk about.
Yes. The most important thing to know is that there is a role for everybody in this rebellion. You don't have to be willing to get arrested. You don't have to quit your job. Most rebellions, historically, the people who take the higher risk actions are a much smaller number of people, and the overwhelming majority of people are people who bring food to the action, give people rides, paint signs, sing songs. We need every single person who's listening to this to do some level of involvement so that we can reach more people. So I just want everyone to know that we need you and there's a role for you. You just have to get in touch with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, B. Ruiz. That's very impressive. And I'm so glad that you people are taking, to me, necessary steps. So keep up the good work. Stay healthy. Take your vitamins and keep in touch.
Thank you very much. Okay. Take care.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And I've just got off the phone, actually, with James, and he is with the local Extinction Rebellion, and in an hour, they're on their way right now to the TECO Tampa headquarters. And so right now, Extinction Rebellion, just in this area, you can follow what they're doing on Facebook, and I will try and find out more about it because I feel that, you know, I feel that it's so urgent. We have done so many segments here on Earth Day, or not Earth Day, excuse me. Well, that too, but the environment. And there are so many statistics that we didn't get into. But let me give you one that actually, to me, I mean, we know about the species. We're knowing about the terrible the situations of drought and flooding. But also that, you know, when you're talking about climate change, at the same time, we should be talking about water. Every time you hear the dangers and the urgency of climate change, think water. And remember, we have all the water we're ever going to get. So we really have to guard it and use it. And, you know, now with the changes, with the drought and the flooding, et cetera, we have way beyond urgent problems. But actually, at the Earth's present population is drawing down twice the amount of water that we have in reserve, and this can't go on much longer. And in fact, it got so urgent in Cape Town last summer that they were literally within a few days of having no water to give to their community. And so the rate of extinction is extraordinary, but we don't have an option of extinction of water. And so people get onto it. I know it seems discouraging, but hey, we made this mess and we have the imagination and the creativity to get out of it. And so again, I am going to remind you at the end of the show, we are going to be giving away Indigo Girl tickets, but they will be $100 pledge. And so again, I don't know how closer to fine we are, but I hope we're doing our thing. So anyway, I'm going to put this on again, and then we're going to come back with Nadine Epstein.
Take my life less seriously. It's only life after all.
going to pod down to Indigo Girls because I know all the issues we're discussing on the show today that they would be interested in and have fought the environmental issues, no doubt about it. But also, they're particularly concerned about everything that's happening in the world. And so I really want to thank a publicist that I work a lot with, Nadine, because actually I was not aware of this magazine or your incredible work. And I have with me on the phone right now Nadine Epstein, and she is the editor of Moment. And so, and luckily I've had two issues, and so I must admit the writing is extraordinary. And so, Nadine Epstein, would you tell us a little bit about Moment and how it has come to be?
Oh, absolutely. Moment was founded in 1975 by Nobel Peace Prize laureate. He hadn't won the Nobel Peace Prize yet, Elie Wiesel, and Leonard Fine, who was a well-known writer in the Jewish world at the time. And it was founded to be like a magazine for the American Jewish community, and it was very independent. And I took the magazine over 15 years ago this month, and I have tried to maintain its independence in a very, very polarized time, in a time that's really different from, I think, any other era that I've lived through. The magazine is fabulous. It's actually a print magazine. We have a beautiful edition. And, of course, you can also find us online at momentmag.com. And we run lots of wonderful projects, giving fellowships to young journalists to write about any kind of prejudice, not just anti-Semitism. So we have just so many wonderful projects, and you can find out about them at momentmag.com.
Well, you know, when Johanna first approached me, would I be interested in doing this? And I thought, oh, yeah, I'm very interested, but I really didn't feel qualified. I mean, and also, as you just said, we live in such an absolutely charged, hyperactive and violent times, and it's almost as if we're all on edge in every way, that you're expecting the explosion, you're kind of expecting it. And so I really didn't feel qualified that I could really approach this with this kind of detail, because I really haven't followed Israeli politics internally that closely. I mean, I followed, like everybody did, the Netanyahu election, etc., and what was happening, but and I know that, and we're seeing anti-Semitism, and we're seeing it, and we're seeing all this nationalism, and you know, that it's reached the point that when you have some Jewish people calling a fellow Jewish person an anti-Semite, you think, I'm not quite sure what's happening here. And so, but then when I read the article, and of course everybody's familiar, I think, with George Soros, he seems to be the whipping boy for everything, you know, whether it's the Women's March, or I think Trump accused him of the immigration march that was on its way up. I found following his story and his experience from the Holocaust, and how he, as a young boy, and his family just managed to escape, that I found that actually, because the Holocaust is such a defining moment in our modern times, I do think, and I found the lessons he took from the Holocaust, how it affected his life, and what his philosophy, so to speak, is now. To me, I think that that is a message that kind of stands contraposed to so much xenophobic nationalism, that I really want to congratulate you, because you took kind of a novice, you might say, and I feel I really gained a great deal from this.
Thank you. I worked for like 6 months on that project, because it was something that, you know, as editor of Moment, again, this was our magazine was founded by a Holocaust survivor, Elie Wiesel. By the way, I just finished a book that just came out this month called Elie Wiesel, An Extraordinary Life and Legacy. So I've been thinking about this a great deal, but I find it deeply disturbing that a Holocaust survivor who was 13 years old when the Nazis invaded his native Hungary, he was about the same age as Elie was, has been called a Nazi and is vilified in the way he's become vilified. I feel like he's really vilified in a way with an intensity that really no other philanthropist is, whether you're on the right or whether you're on the left. Everywhere you go, he's being called a Nazi.
And you constantly hear this anti-Semitic meme that he's this kind of shadowy global financier who's leading a conspiracy to take over the world. And anyone who's studied anti-Semitism knows that that message has been around for, you know, centuries. And it's something that makes me very uncomfortable. So this is one of the reasons why I spent so much time studying this. You know, how this happened, how it came to be that he was called a Nazi, how it came to be that he's been vilified in this way. And, you know, it's really interesting because he did take a very different... I mean, there's a lot... Actually, I'm going to say there's a lot of similarities between Ellie, who I got to know well over the last, you know, 15 years of his life. Actually, about the last 13 years of his life, and who... I felt very, very close to. I've never met George Soros, but both men were about the same age when the Nazis appeared on the scene and changed their lives dramatically. And, you know, they came out with slightly different lessons, but the lessons aren't that different. And I've thought a lot about this because of the new book. But, you know, Ellie was, you know, we never should forget, we need to fight indifference. George Soros came out thinking, you know, I was a minority. I was a Jew. I want to build societies where all minorities are safe, and those are pluralistic societies. So they were both. There was a lot of overlap. They were both very concerned with minorities. They both didn't want the world to go back to what it had been in their childhood. One was a writer, a speaker, an advocate. One that was Ellie. George Soros wanted to be a philosopher who ended up having to get a job and working in banking and became a billionaire. But he was also very well-read. They were both universalists. I think Ellie was also a particularist. He was more concerned with the actual Jewish community. But both of them cared a lot about the world. And I guess that's sort of a little bit of my thought about this. It's really fascinating to me how this happened.
You mean how you got? Well, I was just going to intervene just a little bit because, as I understand it, you were at a global forum in the United States, and you were talking about anti-Semitism, and you were on the panel. And then this woman gets up and says, "We haven't discussed, you know, why haven't you talked about George Soros, who is a Nazi?" And so, if we could, you know, because to me, the fascinating part of this is you really have developed this story so well, really, I think, that we take George Soros and we're looking at this young 13-year-old boy, and the Nazis have come in to Hungary. And so they take a lot of young Jewish boys that age about, and they're kind of couriers. They take the messages to various places. And so his father is a very fine lawyer. And so George takes this message to his father. His father reads it, and he realizes immediately that that the people that receive this will be imprisoned and heaven knows what else. And so he tells them that. And then he realizes that he's very quickly going to be on this list. So then he starts to work and get the kind of papers, et cetera, to save his family. And so then this 13-year-old boy actually is, he's with this German who's not a Jewish person. And he quotes his godfather, and this person isn't well, you can tell the story much better than I can.
Yeah, but you're doing a great job.
Well, but to me it's really fascinating because you have to remember he's 13, and, you know, the Nazis, it's amazing to me, you know, how fast things can happen. And the Nazis come in, and everything has changed, you know, and already, I believe, in Hungary, the Jewish kids can't go to school, you know, so they are being marginalized right off the page, you might say.
Got it.
Yeah.
And this list, by the way, basically the Nazis have created is about for Jewish lawyers, and Jewish lawyers are going to be deported. And George Soros' father realizes that he's going to be on that list soon, but it's alphabetical or something, and he's going to be on that list very soon. So he actually comes up with these very creative ways of getting Christian ID identification papers and forging papers. And he does this not just for the family, but he does this for other people around his community. And he decides that he breaks up his family. He decides that they have two sons, Tivadar Soros and his wife, and one of them is a little bit older than George. And then George is sent to go live with a Hungarian agricultural officer who actually has a Jewish wife, and that Jewish wife is in hiding. And this Jewish agricultural officer is assigned to inventory a Jewish estate, the estate of a wealthy Jewish family who has left and gone to Lisbon, and brings George with him he doesn't want to leave George behind in Budapest, and takes George with him for 3 days while he's inventorying this estate. You know, again, George Soros is 13 years old. He's wandering around. He's worried that people are going to notice that he's Jewish. He's not actively involved in confiscating Jewish materials. And may I say, even if a 13-year-old had done any of these things that, you know, I mean, one has to do what one has to do to survive the Holocaust. But in any case, George Soros didn't, and he was a child, you know, a 13-year-old or a 14-year-old by that point. And he, you know, everyone had to do what they had to do to survive.
And he's 13.
He's 13 years old.
And he's got to be terrified. I mean, I'm sorry, I don't care how cool you are or anything. You've got to be, you realize you don't dare let anyone know you're Jewish. The man's wife is also Jewish. She's in hiding. And then, you know, I can just imagine you walk on eggshells all the time. But then he goes from that to the occupation by the Soviet Union. And so he kind of sees the yin and yang, you might say, of really terrible oppression. And so at 17, he escapes and he gets to London, where he's very influenced by Karl Popper, the London School of Economics.
Absolutely. So he doesn't like totalitarianism, and he certainly doesn't like the Nazis and totalitarianism and fascism, and he certainly doesn't like communism. And he gets out and he goes to England, and he struggles in England. He doesn't actually speak English particularly well. He doesn't have any a real support system in England. He manages to get into the London School of Economics, meets Karl Popper, learns about this whole idea of opening societies and how open societies is the best way to counteract communism, fascism, totalitarianism. And he becomes very excited about this. He graduates with a degree in philosophy, but he wants to be a philosopher. That's his dream. He wants to be an intellectual. But he needs a job, and he finds a job as a salesman. He eventually gets a job at a bank, and then discovers that he has this kind of talent for understanding international markets, many of which are emerging at this time because this is, you know, in the 1970s and 80s. And he moves to the United States, actually, and I think sort of really like the late 50s. He already in the 70s and 80s, once he starts to amass some wealth, he really decides he wants to focus on opening up Eastern Europe. Now, I don't know how many of your listeners have been to Eastern Europe, but I was in Eastern Europe in the 1970s, and it was closed to the world. It was, you know.
Yeah, when the Soviet Union imploded, the sunshine came out.
I mean, I was there by myself, wandering around in Romania and Hungary. Romania, and I was in Hungary, and I was in Bulgaria, and then later on was in East Germany, and no one knew what was going on in the world, and governments controlled all information, and this was something that he basically started sending Xerox machines to all sorts of groups, including the government, so that information would be available more. Be more accessible because information was controlled. He created fellowships where he sent all sorts of people abroad to study in the West. So this is where he starts really getting focused, and he does something that a lot of philanthropists don't do. I mean, he's got this one idea of opening up societies, and it's really where he focuses his money. And this was, again, in the 70s and 80s, and in 1992, something really interesting happens. Something changes. He becomes really notorious because he short sells the British pound.
Who would do that?
and he makes about $1 billion. And until this time, you know, he's just...
a hedge fund manager.
Yeah, he's a hedge fund manager, but he's just another hedge fund manager. And suddenly, everyone notices that he does this, and he becomes sort of an object of curiosity. And there's a lot of TV shows and reporters start getting interested in him and asking him all sorts of questions like, wow, what gives you the balls to do that? How could you, what did you think about that? And he's a bit of a bragger, a boaster. And he's like, well, you know, I survived the Holocaust, I can do this. He says things like that. And this kind of comment starts bringing up what, like, people ask what he did, and he talks about how he survived. And there's Lyndon LaRouche, this is in the 1990s, Lyndon LaRouche, and again, he was a pseudo-libertarian, he just died, actually, a few months ago. He was very old, but he was pseudo-libertarian, he was a conspiracy theorist, and a true anti-Semite, listens to some of this, these interviews, and starts writing in his executive intelligence report that George Soros is a Nazi collaborator. Now, this is also happening in the 90s, and this is when, you know, the Internet is also sort of picking up. You know, suddenly we have this new media, and it gets picked up by reporters, mainstream reporters, who also sort of pick up, ask questions, and often are insinuate. And I don't, and again, I've never met George Soros, and I haven't actually talked to George Soros. I talked to many, many people in his world, friend and foe alike. But there's an insinuation in, like, for example, there's a famous interview in, I think it's 1995 in CBS. And I don't think Soros responds in a particularly, he seems to not even, like, understand what people are getting at, what people are insinuating.
Nadine, because you know this so well, and just in the interest of time, I'm just going to synopsize some of this, because I think we're in a very chaotic time. I really do. Yeah. And I think part of the problem is that here you've had a George Soros, and, you know, events were such that he really couldn't identify with anything, not his Jewish faith, not his country. You know, he really didn't feel Hungarian. He didn't feel like he was British, didn't really feel like he was American. He was kind of floating above it, if you will, and I don't mean that in a good sense. He didn't have much choice. But he's guided by a philosophy that, to me, is really terrific. You know, open societies, that particularly protecting minorities, making sure everyone has their rights. And you're not going to get the kind of totalitarianism if everybody has a right to speak and voice, and you can argue and discuss and work with that. And at the same time, then, you have a very powerful entity that the Soviet Union, which wasn't happy about imploding, and nobody is happy about it. And so you start the revisionism. And so then, you know, that a person actually who funds not the hospitals or the schools, but he funds groups that think, groups that want to have a democracy, groups that want to do this. And of course, this is going to be in opposition to any country that kind of would like to go back to the way they were, or a new version of that. And then you throw his being Jewish, which was not at all in incidental. It was one of the reasons he was in that kind of unusual cloud, if you will, that they are trying to survive. And because of all the violence and the terrorism, it becomes a really tricky game. And everybody needs scapegoats. Everybody needs enemies. And if you've got a person that's committed to a philosophy of openness, which is not popular in any nationalist, and that is that seems to be the theme of the time, everybody's going to go after him.
Yes, and so let me just explain that in the 2000s, he starts giving money to the Democratic Party, and he makes his kind of political views known. And he makes a lot of political enemies in the United States. And cable TV comes along, and then Glenn Beck does this multi-part show in 2010 called George Soros, the Puppet Master. This gets picked up everywhere. And at the same time, you're absolutely correct, you know, we then have this backlash that occurs in Eastern Europe, and it starts with Vladimir Putin, and that triggers this bigger backlash, which we're seeing now again in Eastern Europe, where you've got, you know, Viktor Orban. Viktor Orban was a George Soros fellow.
Yeah, fellow that won scholarship provided by Soros. Payback.
It became politically expedient. He is someone who it became politically expedient for Orban to basically make him into a boogeyman, an enemy. It also becomes politically expedient for Benjamin Netanyahu to do the same thing in 2017. And it's also political expedient for people to say he's anti-Jewish. And you hear this a lot in the Jewish community, that he's anti-Jewish when he's absolutely not anti-Jewish. And then you also hear him called anti-Israel. And again, he's being called anti-Israel because he supports liberal democratic groups that have been, he's been fighting for now years and years and years in Israel. And the and previous prime ministers, you know, Soros was in, like, in the 90s. He went to Israel. He met with Yitzhak Rabin, met with many high
Yeah, he was in such a totally different period of Israel when there really seemingly was a possibility of peace accord and, you know, that there were talks, etc. And there was a lot of hope. And then, bang, he's assassinated. And then, you know, Netanyahu beats Shimon Peres, brings in some American advisors to do it. And, you know, I'm so glad that you talked about all that because it's hard to remember that that period existed because it's so totally different now.
Yeah, and I would say that he you know, George Soros is someone who, you know, wants Israel to exist. Actually, I talk about this in the article, and I interviewed Alex Soros. He's, you know, Alex Soros goes to Israel often. He travels. He, you know, his dad once thought that he that Alex should make Aliyah to Israel. And also, it's very interesting because constantly, George Soros is being accused of being like supporting BDS, and he doesn't support BDS. And in fact, he invests in Israel. His hedge funds, his funds, all invest in Israel, and haven't been investing in Israel as far as I know, since the early 1990s. So a lot of this is, you know, I don't think people realize that. So there's just, yeah, you're right. There's so much here that is about this man that he doesn't.
And again, the articles we're talking about, it's in the moment. And the title is The Vilification of George Soros in Israel. And it's a three-part series. And is it available? Because I've never seen Moment before.
Oh.
I saw this. I hate to say that, but I haven't. So is it available?
You can get Moment at many newsstands. You also can just go to momentmag.com and subscribe to Moment. It's really, I have to say, we worked so hard on this magazine. It's really well written, and it's like a labor of love, and I hope people subscribe. It costs less than $20 to subscribe, and and again, you can also have a digital edition, or you can, you know, get a print edition.
And again, to me, Nadine, and I've really got to wrap this up fast. To me, it's the individual with a dream that's open, that is not just for himself, as opposed to a fierce nationalism that we're seeing throughout the world, you know, which I've got to get mine and protect it from the outsiders. And we're in that moment of history. And it kind of, in a way, I think you've zeroed in on George Soros. And I think it's illustrative of the serious problem we have. And so I really want to thank you. It was a terrific article. I really strongly recommend that people read it and read it carefully because it is well worth the read. And thank you so much for doing it and giving us all this time today.
Thank you so much.
You take care.
Okay.
Bye-bye. And again, that was Nadine Epstein, an editor of Moment, and you are listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. And as I said earlier, that we are going to be giving away, well, actually, it's for a pledge, a $100 pledge for the Indigo Girls. They're going to be here in concert to May 3rd at Ruth Eckert Hall. And so, and again, you've been listening to WMNF Tampa, Sarasota Clearwater, Community Conscious Radio. Thanks so much for listening. We covered a lot of territory. I really appreciate that you hung with us. So, okay, people, go out and do it. Earth Day, it's all happening. And do take care. And so I will, if there's somebody that wants to make that pledge and take those tickets, I will be glad to take it. So thanks a lot for listening. Stay tuned.
In legislation's on the desk of the do-right congressman. And he don't know much about the issues, so he picks up the phone and asks the advice of the senator out in Indian country, darling of the energy companies, ripping off what's left of the reservation.
a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They're sending federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality.